one. There's a sheen of colors like wet road pavement. The figures are barely more than ink swirls, faceless and indistinct, but Branka frowns. There's something about them. They are dirty, these figures, clad in drab non-fashion, with sleeves rolled up to show blackened hands and shoes smeared with grime, and aprons stained with blood, and less identifiable bodily fluids. They loom, these dirty creatures, for whom the word people is a laughable misnomer. And as a haze in the air suggests the smell of wet garbage tangled with evening mist, Branka can almost hear their chatter. It has grown dim and quiet in the gallery room. Strawberry Man Bun stands at the edge of her vision, as if spotlighted, smiling at her, watching her face greedily. No one else moves. But the chatter is not like what she's actually heard walking through Chinatown. Real street chatter there is just talk, a pre-concert warm-up cacophony of tonal languages, English, and a smattering of European from the tourists, interspersed with the laughter of children and the shouts of angry drivers. What Branka hears here in front of the painting is something higher pitched, a gabble. It's late afternoon. What she's hearing isn't what she should be hearing. The wheezy old HVAC should be rattling faintly as it strains against the summer heat. The center faces a major thoroughfare, but where are the traffic sounds from outside? She should hear the buzz of a straight-line saw now and again, as the wood shop turns out requests for center artists. It's just never this quiet in the Bronx Arts Center, not at this time of day. Branka frowns before the painting draws her back from this distraction. A gibber. The faces loom, seeming to shift as Branka takes in the painting. Oh, wait. There's something. She can hear a chitter, like the screechy, chitinous brie of an insect, broken up with distance and movement. Vanessa's voice.
OB. Yo, OB. Branka.
Branka hates it when Vanessa says her name like that, making a syllable of every phoneme. It makes her worry that she's having a stroke, which is why Vanessa does it. Now, a new sound. Something heavy and wet, slapping the polished concrete of the center's floor behind her. It makes her think of a docking line being pulled up onto a pier. She can even smell seawater faintly. She doesn't wonder why someone has unrolled a wet rope in the room, however, because the faces in the painting suddenly seem to loom closer, painted wet and expressionless. They're what's chittering. Jittering. The faces turn to follow her. The faces turn and loom, and they are all around her. A hand grabs Branka's shoulder and yanks her backward sharply. There is a moment in which the universe pauses, stretching just a little. Branka hovers, caught in the pliability of the moment for a long, pent breath. And then reality snaps back into place. She blinks. Vanessa stands beside her, frowning in concern. Her hand is still on Branka's arm. She's the one who pulled Branka back. The painting stands before them, just paint on a surface. Branka has the sudden feeling that it never changed. The room around her, on the other hand. Because Branka is meant to be the guide, she understands precisely what has happened. Although it's a complicated thing to try to think through, and she's glad she probably won't have to actually explain it to anyone. There's a lot to consider. Particle wave theory, meson decay processes, the ethics of quantum colonialism, and more. But when one really gets down to brass tacks, what's happened here is an attack. An attack that came dangerously close to not just killing her, but destroying her. And New York with it.
OB.
That's Vanessa's charming nickname for her, which has caught on among the younger artists who use the center. Vanessa, whose middle name is Brigida, is Young B.
Feeling okay?
You spaced, and... She stops in mid-sentence, mouth still open for the next word despite her hesitation, and then she finally pushes on and says what she was going to say.
I don't know. Shit got weird for a second.
Understatement of the space-time continuum.
I'm good.
She pats Vanessa's hand to reassure her, then turns to face Strawberry Man-Bun and his cronies. Man-Bun isn't smiling anymore, and Doc Holliday is frowning outright.
Cover that shit up,
Bronco snaps at them.
Took me a minute, but I get it now.
Dangerous mental machines, ha!
She looks around and sees confusion on Jess's and Vanessa's faces.
Yi Jing, though. Yi Jing might be an ass, but she at least shares Bronca's love of expensive liberal arts university education.
She's glaring at Doc Holliday, furious anew. So Bronca continues.
Yeah,
that was H.P. Lovecraft's fun little label for folks in Chinatown.
Sorry, Asiatic filth.
He was willing to concede that they might be as intelligent as white people because they knew how to make a buck.
But he didn't think they had souls.
Oh, but he was an equal opportunity hater,
Yi Jing drawls, folding her arms and glaring at the men.
In the same letter, he went in on pretty much everybody. Let's see, if I recall, black people were childlike half-gorillas, Jews were a curse, the Portuguese were simian, whatever. We had a lot of fun deconstructing that one in my thesis seminar.
Shit, even the Portuguese? Vanessa looks impressed. She's half black and half Portuguese, Bronco recalls, and doesn't get on well with her Portuguese relatives.
Yep.
Bronco puts one hand on her hip. They haven't yet covered the painting, which isn't a painting, but Bronco now knows better than to look into it for more than a moment. Jess and the others should be safe, because this attack was aimed solely at the city of New York, or a sufficiently significant portion thereof.
I could see it if you were trying to turn a mirror on Lovecraft, show how twisted his fears and hatreds were. But this painting reinforces them.
This shows you New York as he saw it, the chicken shit low fuck, walking down a street and imagining that every other human being he met wasn't human. So, gentlemen, again, what part of we don't do bigotry do you not understand?
Doc looks stunned that Bronca's still talking. Strawberry Man Bun looks like he's holding in a whole heaping mass of mad, but he puts on a smile and nods for one of the others to rewrap the painting.
Okay,
he says,
you gave it a chance and you still don't like it.
Fair enough.
It isn't enough. Guys like this aren't really interested in fair.
But Bronca steps out of the way to let the group wrap up and remove their work, ending up next to Yi Jing. For the next 10 minutes or so, she and Yi Jing get to play United Flavors of Stink Eye at Man Bun's whole operation. But there's something weird about the whole group of them, Bronca muses while they work. Well, weirder than a bunch of rich kid artists thinking that a taste for stereotypes and fetish porn make them avant-garde. First, there's the painting. Doc and the rest seem immune to it, too, which means they're ordinary people, not like Bronca and the 5 others who are even now wandering around somewhere in the city, probably trying to figure out what they should do with themselves. But no one ordinary could have painted that thing. Second, there's the fact that they even tried this. Why waste time trying to get the center to put their shitty art on display? Why not just use that as a pretext for the meeting, then come out of the gate with the big bad painting and catch Bronca with the element of surprise? Which means there must be more to this. Bronca narrows her eyes.
and looks them over for any sign of a wire. She sees nothing, and she grudgingly concedes she wouldn't know what to look for. She hasn't kept up on surveillance technology for a good 20 years or so. Her son gave her a smartphone, and she actually likes being able to watch movies on it, but it still feels like only yesterday that people were using rotary phones and dialing letter number combos. Something flickers. Branka blinks, her attention caught. Wait, is that a wire after all? Down by Strawberry Man Bun's ankle, as he carries the other end of a crate containing a piece of the bronze sculpture. No. Branka might not know anything about covert listening devices in the 21st century, but she's pretty sure they don't look like a loose shoelace. He's wearing thong sandals, so it can't be that. She grimaces at his nasty toenails. But there, floating just above the long bones of his foot, something is sticking out of the skin. It looks like an especially long and wispy hair, white, not strawberry blonde, at least 6 inches long. Although as Branka watches, it stretches upward, as if trying to touch the crate he's carrying. 9 inches, a foot just shy of the crate's wooden wall, and then it stops and contracts. Not long enough, apparently. It resumes its initial position, just resting along Man Bun's foot, just a hair, trying to play it cool. Maybe it'll try again once it's grown some more. Branka doesn't know what it is, exactly. It does not exist within the lexicon of knowledge that she has absorbed, and that in itself is deeply troubling. But she can add one and one. So when the artist's collective is done, she follows Man Bun to the door. It's close enough to the end of the day. She'll lock up early, give the staff a break after this. But first she says to Man Bun as he's walking out, "Who are you working for?" She expects him to dissemble. He seems the type. Instead, he only smirks and says, "Oh, don't worry. You're going to meet her soon, face to face," she said, "without a bathroom door to protect you." Branka presses her lips together. "It's like that, then. Ask her how that turned out last time," she snaps, and shuts the door in his face. It's a glass door, which makes the gesture less of a fuck you because she can't slam it without risking the glass. But it still feels good to see his smirk fade. And then they're gone. Branka locks the door behind them and watches until they've gotten into their cars, one an enormous Hummer, the other a Tesla, both worth more than she makes in a year, and driven off into the traffic set. Then Branka exhales and turns to face the others. They look shades of mad to worried. "Yeah, so that happened." "I know some guys," Yijing says immediately. "I say I make some phone calls. Fuck those dudes up." Branka raises her eyebrows. "You know people about that life?" "Not unless that means a whole lot of lawyers." She folds her arms. "That was harassment with a side of intimidation. You can't tell me it wasn't. Bunch of fascist dude bros, or whatever they are, coming into a place run by women of color with that art." She puts her fingers up to make air quotes around the last word. "Fuck those motherfuckers." Damn. Not that Branka disagrees. Jess is quiet, though, so Branka prompts her. "Jess?" Jess blinks, then frowns. "I think we need to tell the people using the workshops upstairs that we're shutting down tonight, even for keyholders. Make sure the building is empty." Branka rocks back on her heels, floored, while Vanessa goes, "Whoa!" Yijing immediately starts to complain, but Jess raises her voice enough to talk over all of them. "Just as a precaution," she says, but it's as sharp as a shout. "I'm just saying, because I don't know if you ladies got a brown shirt vibe off those dudes like I did, but I've got 2 grandparents who would smack me sideways if I didn't say this."
The others died in a concentration camp, capiche?
Branka capiches, nodding slowly in grim agreement. Because, well, she grew up missing a few elders, too, and contemporaries, for that matter. It's not paranoia when people are actually setting fires and shooting up nightclubs. But
not the keyholders, Branka says. I'll warn them. But some of them have nowhere else to go.
Several of the center's artists in residence are literal manifestations of the term. Kids kicked out by their families for being queer or neuroatypical or saying no. Adult artists priced out of rooms of one's own. Even one woman Branka's age, who recently left her husband. She makes the most amazing glass sculptures. He beat the shit out of her and destroyed one of her best sets before she started sleeping on a beanbag in her center workshop. The working spaces aren't really designed for habitation, so the center doesn't run afoul of any housing regulations technically. Branka gets around it by periodically reminding the keyholders that the space is to be used only temporarily. She's been saying that to some of them for years. Veneza, her expression grim, moves behind the desk and sits down at the reception computer, doing something Branka can't discern. Jess sighs but says,
"Yeah, okay. Not the keyholders, but warn them at least. And you'd better call the board. Get them ready."
Branka tilts her head, trying to follow where Jess is running.
"For what, a protest or something?"
"Yeah," Veneza interjects.
"Thought so. Come here. I want to show you guys something."
They all move behind the desk to see the monitor. Veneza has a browser window open to YouTube, and she's done some kind of search that's brought up a bunch of videos with lurid title cards and leering faces. Branka's about to ask what she's supposed to be seeing when abruptly she recognizes one of those smirks.
"Hey,"
she points at the screen. It's Strawberry Man Bun.
"Are you fucking kidding me?" Jess mutters before turning away with a groan. "Oh, of course."
"What?" Branka frowns after her, then at Veneza.
"What?" "Yeah. So, I just did a reverse image search on that logo in their email."
Veneza taps a mark at the corner of the video, which Branka remembers seeing elsewhere now, on their emails and on their business cards. It was a warning of how terrible the art was going to be, a stylized A surrounded by vaguely Nordic runes and ugly curlicues, completely unintelligible and hard to remember, which basically defeated the whole point of even having a logo.
"It's the logo of the alt artists. This is their channel."
She clicks on one, enlarges it, and scrolls to somewhere in the middle of its timeline. The screen fills with Strawberry Man Bun's face, looking ripely furious, and with his man bun coming apart from the force of his gesticulations.
"The nail in the coffin. The done it in the who," he is saying.
In the background is what looks like a hotel room.
"This is what these revisionists insist upon. The disrespect for a superior culture that brought them Picasso and Gauguin and mute it,"
Branka says, already annoyed by the sound of his voice. Veneza does so, thank God.
"We get the idea. So these guys are some kind of performance artists. They make shitty art, try to get it into galleries, fail because it's shitty, but then they make a video telling everybody it's reverse racism."
"I guess. It's not that logical. They say whatever gets their audience excited enough to click on the videos or send them donations.
Also, Picasso stole from African artists, and Gauguin was a pedo who gave a bunch of brown girls syphilis, but what the fuck do I know?"
Then she taps the bottom of the video, where Branka has to squint to make out a number.
"It looks like, tell me that K doesn't mean thousand," she says, drawing back in stunned horror as she realizes it. "Tell me 42,000 people haven't watched this shit."
"Yep." Veneza goes back to the search results and points out other horrifically large numbers. That was one of their higher count vids, but still. And like, there's a whole industry of dudes like this. The more inflammatory they are, the more people watch them, and the more money they make. White dude whining is a growth industry, Jess says grimly. She's blonde and cute and pale as paper, so Bronca guesses she gets a frequent dose of white dude whining from types who don't realize she's not quite on the same team before they start with the globalist conspiracy theories. I was going to say we should warn the board about possible violence. But I forgot this is a thing, too. Yeah, says Vanessa. Fans of dudes like this are fucking cultists. Anything he says, they'll suck it up. They'll put your address on the internet, if they can find it, send death threats to your boss, stalk your kids, send a SWAT team to your house, show up with a gun themselves, the works. You guys need to lock down.
Lock down? Bronca stares at her. Lock down what?
Your identities, your personal information. I can help you get started, but we're gonna have to stay late.
They get into it, tossing around plans and fallbacks, while Vanessa hops on endless name search sites and tries to tell them over a couple of hours how to hide the online paper trails of a lifetime. It's dizzying, terrifying stuff. Scarier still, when Bronca suddenly realizes something fundamental about what's changed since her real Spitfire days. Back then, she had to worry about the government tapping her phone. It still probably does, but all the other stuff's been outsourced. Now, instead of just a COINTELPRO operation, she's got to worry about that and some dude stalking her relatives from his mother's basement, and kids bombarding her with death threats because it makes them feel like part of the terrorist gang, and a troll farm in Russia using the center as the next cause célèbre to whip up Nazis. All the people who really are a threat to the country. Somehow they've been convinced to do its dirty work more or less for free. She would admire it if it weren't so damn horrific. By the time they've done as much as they can, because Vanessa can only help them reduce the threat, there's no way to eliminate it entirely. It's late. Yi Jing and Jess head home, while Bronca and Vanessa linger long enough to send out an email to the workshoppers about online safety. Bronca goes outside to let down the night shutters. As she's finishing up, however, Vanessa comes out of the center staff door looking shaken. She's a sturdy kid in a lot of ways, and really Bronca shouldn't call her a kid. Vanessa's done with college. Cooper Union, because she's got a good head on her. But right now, the girl's brown skin is ashen. The bathroom, she murmurs. I don't know, B. It's always creepy in there. But tonight, that last stall just will get me right the fuck out. Bronca grimaces. She should have burned some sage and tobacco, or scrubbed that stall down with ammonia, or both. Yeah. Let's just call that one haunted.
Except it wasn't yesterday. What the hell's changed between yesterday and today? It looks the same, but everything's weird all of a sudden.
Vanessa turns to look over the street. The center sits on a slope overlooking the Bronx River and the on-ramp of the Cross Bronx Expressway, which has finally stopped being a parking lot now that rush hour is over. But beyond this in the distance, the nighttime cityscape spreads across the horizon. Northern Manhattan isn't as impressive as the part of the island that tourists like. Bronca likes this view better, though, because it makes clear that New York is a city of people, not just businesses and landmarks. From here, when the air isn't hazy, one can take in the endless apartment blocks of Inwood and the gigantic public schools of Spanish Harlem, and even a few of the stately row houses that remain on Sugar Hill. Homes and schools and churches and neighborhood bodegas, with only the occasional glass and steel condo high-rise to mar the view. This is a view of the city that only the Bronx sees on the regular, which is why Bronca feels certain Bronx people don't take any shit
from arrogant Manhattanites. End of day. If people want to make a life in New York, they all gotta eat, educate their kids, sleep, and get by somehow. No sense in anybody putting on airs. But Branca also sees what Vanez is picking up on. The city is different, because yesterday it was just a city, and today it is alive. There is precedent for this. There are always those more attuned to a city than others, though usually not when they're from completely different states. Vanez is a Jersey City girl. Branca probes carefully. What do you mean when you say everything's weird? The bathroom stall. Also, that painting those guys had, the last one, she shudders. You were spacing out, so maybe you didn't notice. But everything changed, like the whole gallery. All of a sudden, Yi Jing and those guys were gone, and the room was empty and it got real quiet. The light was strange, and the painting wasn't a painting. She stops abruptly, looking uneasy. And Branca realizes all of a sudden that she's facing a choice about how to deal with Vanessa. She can play it off, tell the girl that what she's sensing is nothing. Daydreams or a flashback from the mushrooms she once told Branca that she tried. Vanessa is so much of what Branca could have been if she'd come up in a better world, and so much of what Branca is now because the world is still a goddamn shit show. Branca wants so badly to protect her. That's ultimately what settles the matter. Because if Vanessa is seeing these things, then she needs to know that they aren't hallucinations. She needs to know to run. The painting was a doorway. Vanessa's head whips around so fast that her afro puffs jiggle. She stares at Branca for a long moment. Then she swallows and says slowly, "And we weren't just looking at a painting of abstract people on an abstract street, were we? We were actually going there to a place that actually looked like that."
Oh, B, I really wanted you to tell me it was another mushroom flashback.
People in hell want ice water, and technically, that was an expressionistic street, but that's just me being pedantic to make myself feel better. Branca smiles sadly. Kinda glad I'm not the only one visiting weird Shittistan, though.
I mean, I got your back anyway, B. But damn!
Damn indeed. Branca sighs, rubbing her eyes, hating for the umpteenth time that this whole mess has dumped itself in her front yard. She's got other shit to deal with, dammit. She should be fixated right now on buying unnecessary cute stuff for her future grandson, granddaughter, or two-spirit child. But here she is, up to her neck in otherworldly art attacks. Yeah, that's... Okay, look, she says, we gotta talk, because you can't have my back on this, see? You don't... You're not. Is there a word for what she and the other five have become? The knowledge that has dumped itself into her mind is long on concepts, but short on vocabulary. You don't have the boots. Vanessa looks down at the sandal she's wearing.
Yeah, it was like 90 degrees today, so...
Branca shakes her head. You drive...
No, short on gas money till payday.
Then come on. It's past the hour when the MTA and New Jersey Transit turn into pumpkins. So let me drive you home. There's, something I need to show you anyway along the way.
Ooh, a mystery. I'm all a flutter.
Vanessa hefts her bag, and they head for Branca's old Jeep. Branca lays it all out on the drive toward Jersey City. It's easier to believe here, along one of the city's thicker arteries, watching the red blood cells of its people and commerce come and go. Above them, clouds backlit by the moon race toward the Palisades, and to the left, ever-present and ever a presence, is the light-speckled silhouette of the city. Tell her everything, that city whispers to Branka, whenever she hesitates over some especially weird or frightening bit of intel. The enemy is different now, craftier, crueler. Help her survive. We like having allies, don't we? Real ones, anyway.
True that.
Then, while Vanessa silently digests what Branka has told her, Branka turns off the expressway just before they would have crossed the bridge that leads to Washington Heights. They're on the edge of the Bronx. Traffic is light here. The streets relatively deserted given the time of night. Nothing but housing projects in the area, and the city's done everything it can to isolate the people who live in them. Fences, highways that cut the neighborhood in half, a no-man's land of industrial blocks hemming the residential area in. There's one sad-looking grocery store in the area that Branka knows of, but they pass 10 payday lenders and dollar stores while she drives, dotting every half-busy thoroughfare like fast-proliferating tumors. When Branka pulls into the gravel road that leads into Bridge Park, it's hard not to feel some apprehension. She remembers the days when the park was just a wasteland of rotted buildings, and nobody hung out here at night except bums, crackheads, and bored teenagers looking for somebody to fuck or fuck with, like a big brown-skinned Indian with a dyke cut who just needed some place to hear herself think. It's not like that now, though. The park has been landscaped into a bland expanse of lawns and benches and dogwood trees that line the old bike trail. These days, there's a whole other kind of danger, because Branka's heard too many stories of the cops hassling neighborhood folks out of the park, so that the more affluent white people moving in will feel safer. And she's still a big, brown-skinned Indian with a dyke cut, here late at night in the company of a young black woman for no reason that a bigoted cop would be able or willing to understand. She's not quite the same woman, though. As Branka parks and gets out, she reaches for her city, and the city sighs a long purr of pleasure in response. No one will interfere, it promises without words. This is our place, no matter what interlopers think. Come and show her yourself. She shivers a little, hearing voices. Even if it's not so much a voice as a stream of impressions and feelings, really should freak her out. It doesn't, though. So, I'm a little freaked out, Vanessa says. When Branka turns, the younger woman is eyeing her skeptically. Like, if I were a dude, I'd be pulling out the pepper spray that you don't know I have.
Pepper spray is legal in the city.
I know Jersey dumbasses think we're all peace-loving hippies here, but read a website, damn. Oh, well, just saying. You're being unusually weird.
Branka laughs. Yeah, that's not gonna get any better. But there are some things that I'm not sure I can explain with words. Come on.
The Harlem River spreads beyond the cobbled path and the railings. There's not much to see at this point, east of the more dramatic skylines of Washington Heights and well south of the true suburbs of Yonkers and Mount Vernon. Just a murky, poorly lit river running sluggishly in the warm night air. There's a low, graffiti-flecked wall on the Washington Heights side of the river running along Harlem River Drive. But for the Bronx, it's nothing but shoreline, which is twisty with fallen tree branches and moss-slimed rocks and a couple of old rusty shopping carts that have been there for as long as Branka can remember. The water smells faintly of sulfur, because there's probably a sewage spill somewhere. This part of the Bronx is on the come-up, but it's been poor as shit for a long time. And this is a city where politicians don't care about infrastructure, even for wealthier neighborhoods. A different kind of infrastructure has made itself present, though. As of about 11:54 a.m. Eastern time, Branka walks down to the water, her footing sure and quick. Vanessa follows, much more carefully. When Branka stops, Vanessa almost slips on a wet rock, though she catches herself.
OB, if you decided to go serial killer on me, just stab me on solid ground, okay? I don't want to die in this nasty shit catching fucking chlamydia or something.
Branka laughs, then holds out her arm for Vanessa to grab onto.
You should be able to see it from here.
Okay. She points down the riverbank. Tell me what you see.
Vanessa looks. Branka can tell that all she's noticing are the darker shadows of tree roots and old pipes against the water.
Your tax dollars not at work. What am I supposed to be seeing?
Just shut up for a minute. Let me...
Hard to do two things at once, be in two places at once, think with two selves at once. But this is important.
I'm gonna flex.
If Vanessa has a smart remark in reply to this, Branka doesn't hear it because she has subsumed herself into the sound of the water and the chirr of the insects and the endless drone of cars making their way over the expressways and the GW in the distance. But that isn't the only sound she can hear, is it? It is beneath the others, the pillars supporting them, the metronome giving them rhythm and meaning. Breathing. Purring.
A lot of stuff is fucked up and wrong in New York. But isn't that part of the city, too? Situation normal.
So even though it is only half awake, and its avatars are scattered and afraid, and its streets teem with parasites trying to burrow underneath and multiply and kill the host, here in this place, the Bronx dreams peacefully. Here. Branka may be all that she truly is. So she lifts a foot and puts it down twice. Lifts it again, taps twice, turns. The city's hum rises to a song. Its heart beats fast. These are her rhythms. She turns with them, dancing from rock to rock, catching the weight of her movements with her core so that her steps fall lightly. This is the dance.
This is the story,
she says. Her eyes have shut. She doesn't need to see the rocks or watch for slippery spots. The rocks are grandfathers who have invited her feet, so she goes where they have bidden. The story is in her, flowing, guiding her steps. Dance is a prayer. And though she has not danced like this in years, not since she stopped going to the powwows and stopped enjoying the dyke clubs and stopped tromping through brickyards to embrace the strength of the land underneath, it comes back to her like she's never left. This is the city. The city is her.
This is my finger.
Branka says aloud. She lifts one hand, palm down, fingers loose. Then she lifts her index finger. In the near distance, maybe 30 feet off, one of the massive curving pipes that arcs into the river moves. With a hollow metallic groan, it rises from the water, uncurls, still rising, until it sticks straight out over the water at the same angle as Branka's finger. Branka keeps the arm up even as she turns and leaps onto another stone so that Vanessa can see. Branka opens her eyes then and glances at Vanessa, who is staring at the pipe, her mouth hanging open. Branka smiles and brings the dance to a halt physically. In her mind, however, she's still dancing. She is the city and the land underneath, and because of that, she will always dance.
This is what I've been trying to tell you,
Branka says, still holding her arm up. Now Vanessa is staring at Branka.
This is the change in the city that you've been sensing, and the truth you have to remember. Whatever you see, first and foremost, it's real. Second, it can be dangerous. Understood?
Vanessa shakes her head slowly, but Branka suspects this is less denial than amazement.
Can you make, I don't know,
any part of the city do anything?
Yeah, I can. Some parts easier than others. But that's nothing.
Branka curls her finger again, and the pipe grumbles back into place. Then she lifts her other arm, grinning as she watches Veneza, because even though this is the dance, and she knows what will happen intellectually, it's still an altogether different thing to experience. And some things are best experienced through the eyes of the young. So when the river rises into the air, the whole 500-foot-wide expanse of it, and curls an elbow and a wrist, and long, watery fingers like some kind of immense spectral Rosie the Riveter parody, it is Veneza's delight that settles Branka's heart. Branka never wanted this, and even though she knows why she was chosen, how important it is, she has not known how to feel about any of it, except resignation and frustration and dread. Now, though, as Veneza goes, "Holy fucking shit," it feels good for the first time. She allows herself a bit of smugness.
"It is pretty damn rad, huh?"
"Nobody says rad anymore, OB, damn."
"Yeah, well, they should. Always liked that one."
"You know, though," Veneza frowns a little, "this is pretty small if it's symbolically part of you. I mean, if that's your arm, then the rest of you ends, like, just across the street from the park."
"It's not exactly proportional."
Nor does the burrow emulate her body in any predictable shape or way. This riverbank has 1,000 potential fingers to her 5, for example, and some of them have claws. The burrow's heart is actually a different river. The Bronx River, of course. The burrow's teeth, rotting but still sharp, are the isolated projects. Its ears are 1,000 recording studios, all born of the boogie down sound. And its bones are the stones underneath it all, ancient as ancestors. Veneza can't seem to take her eyes off the water arm.
"Can you make it flip me off?"
Branka snorts and turns her hand to lift the middle finger. The river follows, twisting about, and when a 50-foot column of water lifts from the middle of its fist-like mass, a spritz of droplets hits them both in the face.
"Oh, gross," Veneza cries.
But she's laughing, even as she mops herself off. Then she blinks, staring, because Branka has lifted the river from its bed. And yet, there is the river, flowing along quietly, as it has for millennia.
"This isn't the same kind of real as what you're used to," Branka says gently.
"What, it's a hallucination? Goddamn polluted river water in my face?"
"It's not a hallucination. It's just that reality isn't binary."
She sighs and uncurls her arm, relaxes her fingers. The great water arm shifts back into the middle of the river and straightens out, becoming again the river that it has been all along.
"There are lots of New Yorks," she explains. "And some of them, you turned right coming out of the subway this morning. In others, you turned left. And you also rode a dinosaur to work. And somewhere else you ate some funky ant ball snacks at lunch. And somewhere else you got a side gig as an opera singer. All of those things are possible. All of them have happened. Got it?"
"Like science fiction?"
Veneza tilts her head, eyes narrowing in thought. "The many worlds interpretation? Quantum physics? Is that what we're talking about?"
"Hey, if it wasn't on Star Trek, I don't know."
Though Branka does have a vague memory of a weird episode about a mirrored universe where everyone was evil, somehow signified by men wearing goatees. And in this universe, they wear man buns, whatever.
"I'm going to tell you a creation story," Branka says. "It's not like the ones my people tell, not even like the ones your people tell. The one I'm about to tell you is,"
she considers, then laughs as she thinks of a term,
"more like a unified field theory of creation. So try to follow along." A long time ago, when existence was young, there was just one world that was full of life. No one can say if it was bad or good. It was life. She shrugs.
The river beside them runs through other plains where other Broncas speak. 1,000 other tellers telling 1,000 other tales beneath 10,000 different skies. If Bronca concentrates, she can see them. Skies where a second sun has risen, or the night air is purple and gold and burns with what would be toxic to her. She tries not to see them, however. Veneza deserves her full attention for now. And it's dangerous even to look at some things. The city has warned her about this.
That first world, that first life was a miraculous thing. But each decision those living beings made fissioned off a new world. One where some of them turned left and another where some turned right. Then each of those worlds fissioned off more worlds of their own and so on and so on. How do you top a miracle? You don't. You just make another universe, which will start making its own miracles. And so life proliferated across 1,000 million universes, each one stranger than the last.
Bronca repositions her hands, one flattened in the air a few inches above the other. Then she ladders them, one above the other, to suggest many layers. A millefeuille of worlds she means to suggest, each building on the other, forming coral columns that rise and split and twist apart and split again. An endlessly growing tree sprung from a single tiny seed, whose branches are each so wildly different that life on one would be unrecognizable to life on another, with one important exception.
Cities traverse the layers.
In this world, Bronca points at the skyline that rises above the trees of Bridge Park on their side of the river.
People still tell stories of how terrible the Bronx is. At the same time, somewhere some realtor is talking up how amazing it is, so that people with money will come and buy up everything. At the same time, there are the folks who live here, for whom it's neither terrible nor amazing, it just is. All of these things are true. And that's just within our own reality. It's not just decisions, is what I'm trying to say. It's every legend of this city, every lie, those become new worlds too. All of them add to the mass that is New York, until finally, all of it collapses under its own weight and becomes something new, something alive.
Fuck yeah, says the voice in her head.
Shut up, sweetie, I'm busy, she sings back.
Veneza is turning, looking at the trees and the water and the night lights as if it's all new.
It is?
She says in a tone of wonder,
always used to look at the city from the rooftop at home.
Huh. It always looked like it was breathing.
It was. Just a little, then.
Fetuses breathe their own amniotic fluids, consuming themselves as practice for the day when they will metabolize something wholly different.
But today, everything changed. After today, the city's going to be alive in a way that it wasn't before.
Why today?
Bronca shrugs. The stars aligned? The creator got bored? I don't know. The timing doesn't matter. The event does.
Yeah. I guess I'm not paying attention to the right things.
Then as a sobers. That painting today. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Bronca needs to stop showing off. She sighs and turns away from the rocks, beckoning for Veneza to follow her back toward the jeep.
Right, the painting. Basically, one of the realities out there is not super jazzed that our reality exists. Fuck if I know why. But whatever the reason, something from that reality tries to kill cities whenever they become alive the way New York has just done. They tried this morning and did some damage, but failed in the big push.
Then as his eyes widen,
oh shit,
the Williamsburg.
Branka nods grimly.
Which could have been a lot worse. It was going for the whole city, like I said. Something stopped it. Someone like me. Another person who is now the city.
What, like?
Vanessa pauses, frowning.
There's more people who can make the river move?
There are 6 of us. One for each borough and another who's the whole city. That's the one who stopped the attack this morning. That entity from another universe. The enemy, her mind whispers, is still here, though. And something's changed about the way it presents itself. It's supposed to be a horrible big thing that attacks cities at the moment of their birth. That's how it's always happened before, always, across thousands of years. Now, though, its tactics have changed. And that's got Branka very worried.
There is nothing in the lexicon about the enemy co-opting human minions to deliver monstrous paintings.
Are the others having this kind of trouble, too? Maybe she should... No. No.
Beyond preparing Vanessa as best Branka can, she's staying out of this fight.
Ooh, the painting.
Vanessa, whose thoughts have obviously followed the same path, shivers visibly.
Stuff in it was moving.
She trails off, her voice haunted.
Remember what I said about life from those other places not being something that even looks alive to us?
What? There are actually people who look like two-dimensional paint smears somewhere out there? Vanessa shakes her head. Fuck. That was what had made the paint figure so creepy, really. To know that the things she was seeing weren't just mindless, swirl-faced monsters, but things with minds and feelings. Minds as incomprehensibly alien as Lovecraft once imagined his fellow human beings to be. They get in the car, and Branka turns them back toward the expressway heading for New Jersey. Vanessa's quiet beside her, digesting what she said. But there's one more important bit that Branka has to get across. So, she takes her eyes off the road just long enough to fix them on Vanessa. This part is important. Remember that thing I did with the river? I did the same thing at the center today. If I'm careful, if I do things right, I can push those people, the enemy, back into their world, or at least out of my immediate vicinity. You, though, you can't do that. So next time you see some fucked up shit, come get you, got it?
Well, yeah, that works too, but if I'm not around, book it. Run away, not toward it like you did today, okay?
At this, however, Vanessa scowls.
If I hadn't run toward the crazy and pulled you back when they started reaching for you with all the little,
she waggles her fingers and makes a face. Branka frowns in surprise.
Those things had been reaching for her?
Then you would have been, I don't know, paint food.
She's so damn stubborn. Well, if I'm not in imminent danger that you can save me from, get the fuck out. Because I don't want to think about what will happen if those things grab you.
When Vanessa's jaw sets, Branka pulls out the big guns.
Please, do it for me.
Vanessa winces, but some of the stubbornness goes out of her.
Damn it. Fine. Okay, then.
She frowns a little, though, troubled.
But why could I see it when Yeege and Jess couldn't?
They didn't move, actually, while it was happening. It was like they were in a freeze frame with the lights down low. Same with those guys who brought the painting.
You, though, were normal-looking, and me, I wasn't frozen at all. Why?
There are always people around who are closer to the city than others. Some of them become like me, and others just serve the city's will as needed.
Vanessa gasps.
Oh, shit.
You mean I could have been like you? Maybe, yeah, if you weren't from New Jersey.
Oh, fuck.
It's a testament to the fact that Vanessa isn't a kid, though she acts like one sometimes, that she doesn't seem thrilled by the prospect of developing extra-dimensional superpowers. She grips the Jeep's door handle instead, as if she needs it to feel more secure.
Jesus, B. So, I mean, it's awesome that, you're a city. Congratulations. I want to be accepting of this new stage in your identity formation. But if people are showing up at work to try and swallow you with paint monsters, what are you going to do if you get doxxed? Those things in your house.
Bronca's been trying not to think about that. Hell if I know.
Vanessa remains silent for the rest of the ride to Jersey City, which is only another 10 minutes or so. When Bronca pulls up to Vanessa's apartment building, a small, nondescript low-rise across the street from a half-vacant lot, she stops at the curb. Vanessa doesn't get out, though.
You need to crash with me,
she asks Bronca in perfect seriousness. Bronca blinks in surprise.
You live in a studio.
Right. No roommates, luxury living.
You don't have a couch.
There's a whole 2x6 trash-free space on my carpet, I have you know. Or hell, share the bed.
I changed the sheets like 5 days ago. 7, 8. Okay, I'll change the sheets.
Bronca shakes her head, bemused.
No homo.
Not with you, anyway.
I swear I won't ravish you in your sleep, Bee.
Vanessa glares at her despite the banter. Even though you did just tell me that an entire universe is worth of city-eating monsters out there trying to fuck you up.
So maybe you could stop worrying about your virtue for a minute and think about your life instead.
She really is a sweetheart. Bronca sighs, then reaches over to ruffle her puffs. Vanessa pretends to dodge, but then she permits it because she doesn't really mind. Because Bronca makes sure they still look cute afterward.
I can keep those things out of my building, Bronca says. I think. But to do even that much, I need to be in New York, the city I'm part of, which is not the city we're in right now.
Oh, Vanessa sighs. Right. Forgot this whole thing has rules.
She gets out of the car, taking more time to get her purse out of the back seat than is strictly necessary. By this, Bronca knows she's still trying to think of a way to help.
Hey.
When Vanessa looks up, Bronca nods at her.
I'm gonna be fine.
I was at Stonewall. I stomped on a cop. Yeah, I know. Informants aren't paint monsters from the fucking id.
It's called the Ur.
Bronca thinks, but she scared Vanessa enough.
Either way, I got this. Good night.
Grumbling, Vanessa shuts the door. Bronca watches till she's inside, then heads home. And as the city welcomes her back within its borders, she prays to any god that will listen across any dimension that her friend will be safe. Chapter 7. The Thing in Mrs. Yu's Pool. The Queen is in Queens, contemplating the stochastic processes of a trinomial tree model on the strange warm day when everything changes. The Queen, whose real name is Padmini Prakash, doesn't want to be working on her computational analysis project, which is why she happens to be daydreaming about some Lovecraft meta that she read on Tumblr and looking outside in the moment of the city's rebirth. The meta wasn't so much interesting as funny, science side Tumblr, arguing with fantasy side over the comical notion that non-Euclidean geometry could somehow be sinister, and concluding that Lovecraft was probably just scared of math. The view through her window isn't especially interesting either. Just a westerly view of Queens's myriad of neighborhoods and churches and billboards, with the very Euclidean spires of Manhattan looming beyond. It's a bright sunny June day, all of 11:53 a.m., and the day's a-wasting, as Americans say. So with a heavy sigh, Padmini turns her attention back to her work. She hates financial engineering, which is, of course, why she's getting a master's degree in it. She would prefer pure mathematics, where one might elegantly apply theories toward the cleaner, or at least decontextualized, goal of understanding processes, thought, and the universe itself. But it's a lot harder to get a job in math than finance these days, especially with the H-1B lottery getting tighter, and the ICE Gestapo waiting to swoop in on any pretext. So here she is. Then something, instinct maybe, prompts Padmini to look up again. Thus, she is staring directly at the Manhattan horizon in the precise moment when a titanic tentacle curls up from the East River and smashes the Williamsburg Bridge. She actually doesn't know which bridge it is at first. She can't remember one from another. Still, the tentacle must be pretty big for her to be able to discern that it's a tentacle at all. That's not real, she thinks, with the instant scorn of any true New Yorker. Just 2 days before, big white film production trailers took over her entire block. That happens all the bloody time these days, because movie people invariably seem to want multicultural working-class New York as backdrop for their all-white upper-class dramedies, which means Queens, since East New York is still too black for their tastes, and the Bronx has a reputation. Given that the tentacle is enormous but translucent, rising above the waterfront condos of Long Island City and flickering like a poorly connected monitor or cheap special effects, naturally Padmini concludes that it's some kind of hoax. 2012 called. It wants the Tupac hologram back. And then she giggles, inordinately pleased by her own cleverness. Math queen's got jokes. But the tentacle is awfully heavy-looking as it strikes the bridge. Padmini must concede that they got the detail right in the special effects. Heavy masses displace more air than smaller things, and the lag caused by that much friction would make for visibly sluggish momentum. This tentacle is going just a little too fast to be in freefall, but Padmini figures that they can tweak it in post-production. Or maybe they'll play it off by saying the tentacle is just phenomenally strong. That wouldn't ruin the audience's suspension of disbelief. As the tentacle hits the bridge twists up in holographic silence. But an instant later, the wind shifts and carries with it the sound of metal tearing and concrete cracking and horns blowing. Padmini's apartment building shudders and... now there are screams, dopplered by distance but unmistakable. All the way in Jackson Heights, miles from Williamsburg, even as the crow flies. Padmini can hear screams. Then riding somewhere behind that sound wave comes a wave of emotion, anticipation, dread, and excitement. Something is wrong. But also right. All around her, there is a sudden and intense rightness, shivering through the trees of her building's backyard and thrumming up through the old frame house's foundation. Dust puffs through cracks in the walls. She inhales the faint scent of mildew and rat droppings, and it's disgusting. But it's right. At her desk, she pushes herself up, driven to her feet by restlessness. In the same instant, not far off, a subway goes by along one of the elevated tracks. For an instant, she is rushing along with the train. Is the train fast, powerful, aching for a coating of graffiti along her sleek but boring silver skin? And then she's just herself. Just a tired young graduate student past her prime at the ripe old age of 25, according to fashion magazines, leaning close to the window of a borrowed bedroom, and trying to understand how the world has suddenly changed. All at once, her mouth goes dry with an instinctive awareness that something else is wrong. And this time, it's a lot closer than the East River. Near. Here. Her head whips about, almost of its own volition, almost as if something has taken hold of her ponytail and yanked on it to direct her attention where it is needed. There. The backyard. Not the one attached to her own building, which is paved over and contains only weeds and the rusted-out barrel of their downstairs neighbor's former barbecue pit. The one next door. Mrs. Yu lives in that garden apartment, and she's decided that a backyard needs a pool, probably because she used to live in Texas, where that was a thing people did. It's just a little above-ground thing, dingy and cracked after only 2 New York winters. At barely more than 8 feet wide, it takes up nearly the entirety of the yard. Still, it's a hot June day, so 2 of Mrs. Yu's grandsons are hard at play in the water, giggling and squealing loudly enough to almost drown out the screams from Williamsburg. And do they not notice the way the water suddenly changes color as the bright blue plastic bottom of the pool transforms into something else? Something grayish white, something altogether stranger than plastic, something moving with a slow, organic undulation that Padmini can see even through the rippling water. No, they don't notice, because they are unironically playing Marco Polo, yelling at each other in a mix of Mandarin and English, and splashing wildly to get away from each other. One's got his eyes closed, the other is fixated on the first, and neither has put his feet down on the pool bottom. They're small boys, but the pool is tiny too. They're going to touch the bottom eventually. Padmini is up from the desk and tearing through the apartment to reach the door before she can think. If she did think, she would decide that she's being foolish. If her conscious mind were fully engaged, she would tell herself that even if her sudden intense belief about touching the grayness at the bottom of the pool is rooted in any sort of truth, she cannot possibly make it to the ground level and to Mrs. Yu's front door in time. She cannot make it through Mrs. Yu's house quickly enough. If the old woman even lets her in without first wanting a half hour's worth of small talk because Mrs. Yu is lonely, and into the backyard before the boys touch the bottom of the pool. If she were thinking, she would convince herself that her sudden intense belief is irrational. Really? She would ask herself in scorn. And what's next? Stepping on a crack really does break your mother's back. But she knows it's real. It has been given unto her to understand the mechanics of the whole business, so she instinctively knows that water is the helpmeet of the enemy. Not a doorway in and out of itself, but a lubricant of sorts, facilitating easier traverse. The thing in the pool will do worse than kill the boys. It will take them away. To where and for what? Who knows? But it can't happen. So in her panic, Padmini pelts through the door of the apartment and halfway down the 4th floor flight of stairs without so much as stopping to grab her keys. The door swings wide open behind her. Aishwara Auntie calls after her in startlement. Her baby cousin starts crying. Padmini doesn't even close it. She puts her hand on the banister and thinks, no, must get there now. And because she is what she is, she envisions herself accelerating to get there, not magically, but mathematically, through the walls and the backyard fences and air and space. The transit from point A to B would take T equals pi times the square root of a squared minus R sub zero squared divided by A times G time, where G equals the gravitational constant times mass divided by a squared, which is also equivalent to 4/3 pi rho A multiplied by the gravitational constant, is the surface gravity of the arc of a hypocycloid. And the instant she thinks this, a voice inside her head answers, oh, that's what you want to do. Okay, no problem. Then the walls of her old building bend around her, warping, until she is not running downstairs, but flying. More than flying, rushing through a tunnel as if she is a bullet, and the whole world has become the gun. And then she is running across grass. She is in Mrs. Hughes' backyard. She is at the edge of the pool, grabbing one boy and hauling him out by the shoulders. He screams, kicking and punches her in the face, knocking her glasses onto the grass. The other boy screams, too, for their grandmother. Padmini has the first boy on the grass. He's safe there. The grass is solid, ground, and feels right. But the boy is still screaming, and he kicks at her, grabs her hair, tries his damnedest to impede her as she tries to get up for the other boy. The first boy weighs all of 50 pounds, but he goes for her knee and then punches her in the belly. "I'm..." Padmini cries, but before she can get the next word out, there is an entirely different kind of scream from the pool that stops both of them cold. Mrs. Yu comes out onto the back porch, a bamboo strainer brandished in one hand. She stops and stares at the pool. They all stare, in fact. In the pool, the other boy has stood up on the grayish-white bottom, which, close up, is not just grayish-white, but mottled, and some of it is scarred, because it is skin, and not plastic or earth. And now, tendrils of that grayness have whipped up from the bottom of the pool to wrap themselves around the boy's legs. After a moment's horrified staring down at himself, the boy starts screaming again, this time splashing wildly to get out, but he can't use his legs. As Padmini watches, the tendrils move up and over his trunks, up his waist. He swats frantically at them, and they whip up to catch one arm, lickety-split, pinning it down. And his feet are gone all of a sudden. They have vanished into the now amorphous gray substance, which is bubbling and rising around him, swallowing him from the ankles up and dragging him under. Mrs. Yu shouts and runs down to the pool. Padmini belatedly shakes off shock and runs over as well. Between the two women, they grab the boy's flailing hand. The gray stuff is fearsomely strong as it pulls on him. Padmini pulls back with everything she's got, but she is an overweight, overworked graduate student, not the rock. The boy is terrified, his face staring up at them, even as fingers of the gray stuff start worming up around his face. She can't stand the sight of it. She doesn't want to touch it. And indeed, every particle of her screams against doing so because it is something inimical to her. And yet she cannot let this child be taken without using everything she's got to fight back. And suddenly, she thinks of fluid mechanics. Fluid mechanics are beautiful. The equations jump and ripple, push and ebb. It is nothing to Padmini to run the equations for flow velocity through her mind. Nothing to change the variables to increase that velocity down close to the boy's skin. Water is a lubricant, but if she can just imagine something that is a better lubricant between his skin and the gray substance, faster and more fluid than water should ever be. The pool is a tumbling rapids of churning water. Padmini cannot see the tendrils anymore amid the froth, but she is hyper-aware of them as she pulls. And Mrs. Yu pulls, and even the first boy grabs onto Mrs. Yu's waist from behind and pulls. No! Padmini shouts in defiance at the gray thing in between desperate gasps for air. But meanwhile, she is thinking,
the dot product of vector u and the gradient of u plus the partial derivative of u with respect to t multiplied by rho equals the negative gradient of p plus the divergent of vector t sub d plus vector f.
Where f equals infinity, if that's how much force it takes to get this disgusting thing off the child. It works. The thing's tendrils slip free and the boy comes skiing out of the pool as if buttered and fired from a buttered child cannon. Padmini takes the brunt of the blow, which is good, because Mrs. Yu has osteoporosis. The boy bowls Padmini back, and though she lies winded on the ground with a small sobbing child curled up against her, she is elated, ecstatic. Who knows if the thing in the pool will stay there or if she'll be able to save anyone if it crawls out of the water and tries to eat them again. It doesn't matter. For the first time in years, it seems, she's done something not just because she's expected to do it, but because she's chosen to do it, and done the hell out of it besides.
And don't fucking bring your squamous eldritch bullshit here,
she gasps, grinning, without really hearing herself. It is as if these words set off a bomb. She feels something. A wave of outgoing force seemed to tingle away from her feet and the crown of her head and her butt where it crushes the grass as she sits up. She can even see the wave as its energy crawls across the grass and over Mrs. Yu's apartment building and the old pool. There is a hiss from somewhere below the pool as this force moves across it. The water in the pool roils. The boy in her arms cringes and makes a sound of fear. But Padmini knows that this is a good thing, this change. She staggers to her feet. The boy is heavy. But by the time she's up, she already knows what she'll see. Mrs. Yu's pool bottom is turned back to pale blue plastic. The portal to another place, where pool bottoms are made of devouring skin, is gone. So Padmini wraps her arms around the weeping child, shuts her eyes, and privately vows to make an immediate offering at her tiny, neglected puja table. Well, the bag of fruit she bought last week has already manifested flies and might have gone moldy. Okay, she'll offer incense instead, the really good stuff. And a little while after all this, two very weird strangers show up.
Good thing we came here first, Manny says.
He's standing by the backyard pool that almost swallowed Queens. It's just an ordinary pool now, but in the other world that Manny can see, the entire empty twilight backyard, it never seems to grow fully dark in weird New York or fully light, is layered over with the massive, glowing parallel marks of something that has clawed at this place and very nearly rent it open. The marks are healed now. Just. Manny can feel their rawness. Worse, the air smells of strange oceanic aldehydes, and somewhere else, not in weird New York but troublingly close by, he can hear the very faint, lingering roar of frustration from something immense and inhuman that almost broke through. Back in this world, he can hear Mrs. Yu through the apartment window, still saying soothing things to her grandsons while she feeds them to calm them down further. The younger boy has taken no lasting harm from his encounter with the pool bottom monster, though Nanny's pretty sure he'll never be coaxed into a swimming pool again, and even bath time might be a problem from here forth. Not that he blames the boy. Nanny's creeped out just standing 5 feet from where it happened.
Is it really a good thing? Brooklyn asks.
Mrs. Yu's place sits on a gradual hill. They gaze out over endless backyards and houses sloping away from where they stand.
We got here too late. If that young lady hadn't figured out how to push this thing back into wherever it came from, we'd have gotten here to find all these people dead or gone.
Manny shudders at the thought. Some things, he understands instinctively, are worse than death.
I guess you're right. She got lucky. We all have been so far.
Though he does not add, but it only takes one mistake. Brooklyn knows it anyway.
It sounds like the thing that was in this pool is a more, violent version of the patches of tendrils or feathers we've seen,
Manny says.
And then he has a horrifying thought. It might even be the same thing. I keep thinking about how at the park, she kept switching between we and I, like the pronouns were interchangeable. Like she couldn't keep the words straight, and they didn't really matter anyway.
Maybe this isn't her first language. That's partly it. But Manny suspects the problem is less linguistic than contextual. She doesn't get English because English draws a distinction between the individual self and the collective plural. And wherever she comes from, whatever she is, that difference doesn't mean the same thing, if there is a difference at all.
Those things in the park did what she wanted, Brooklyn says. It's also clear that she is responsible for what happened at the bridge somehow. And apparently, FDR Drive. And here, you saw how much time it's taken us to travel from one point in the city to another. She couldn't possibly be in all these places personally. Some of this stuff happened at the same time. across the city from each other. So maybe she's, I don't know, like a fungus. Everywhere, all over the city, but we only see the bits that poke up here and there.
Ooh, says the woman they've come to meet, who excuses herself, and then turns away from where she's been carrying on an intent conversation with an older woman nearby. She's still sitting on Mrs. Yu's backyard steps. The older woman, standing beside her, settles into an aggressively defensive posture with her arms folded and chin jutted forth. But she says nothing as Padmini speaks.
Did you have to go to Fungus?
The living embodiment of the borough of Queens is a tiny thing, busty and dark brown, with a wealth of long black hair that's stiff from having been soaked in chlorinated pool water and not rinsed before it dried. She's introduced herself to them as Padmini, like the actress, and has apparently resigned herself to having a name they do not recognize.